continuity to the unconscious processes, at home, at play, at work, according to Freud and Resident Cohen, and the continuity of the red of the Thanksgiving cranberry and the potential red of human bloodshed we observe nightly on our beat is pleasing to our senses. "This Cohen is talking to you about the unconscious," I said. "As Freud discovered, and as Cohen points out," said Quick, "the process of free association is liberating, enabling the darkness of the child policeman to light up with the understanding of the adult. See this lead billy club?" I saw it. "The crack of this lead stick on the elbow is a more sure and fail-safe blow, much to the consternation of those writing TV thrillers," said Quick. "To crack an elbow with the understanding of the childhood unconscious is almost free of guilt." "You have only Cohen to thank," said Gilheeny, "for teaching the technique of the free association. Cohen and that master of the Jewish race, Freud. And we have high hopes for you, Roy, for like a racehorse, your track record is among the best." "You're a man who looks great on paper," twitched Gilheeny, "humane, yet athletic. The Rhodes Will of 1903 says, I do believe, to choose the best men for the world's fight, does it not?" We were interrupted by a shriek from the grenade room. "Goive! Goive! Goive!" My heart sank. A room 116 Gomer. Even to put on the semblance of a buff before turfing upstairs was, at that point, too much. "Do not presume," said Gilheeny. "One of the thieves was killed. Do not despair. One of the thieves was saved." "Augustine, of course," said Quick. "Where the hell did you learn that?" I blurted out, without thinking, and then blushed at the implication that these policemen were just two dumb, lanky Irishmen. Our source for this was a remarkable firebrand of a minuscule Jew, a veritable Herzl, said Gilheeny, ignoring my rudeness. "His name will be familiar. It is inscribed in the hearts of all, and above the lintel of room 116, the room named after him." "Grenade room Dubler?" I asked. "The complete intern. Dubler knew all the fundamentals and tricky shortcuts that made him a medical wizard. Without question, in our knowledge of 20 years in God's house, Dubler was the best." "Well, I'd like to hear about him, but I've got to go see that Gomer," I said, picking up my bag to go, yet wanting to hear more about this enticing and eccentric Dubler. "No need, man," said Gilheeny, putting a fat hand on mine. "No need. We all know her, Ina Guber, the archetype, and we have already put as much of a buff as we could. She is with your pal Chuck at this very moment." "You treated her?" I asked in some amazement. "She is beyond treatment. She needs nothing but a new nursing home bed, as hers has been sold. There is no need for you to see her, for she is virtually on her elevator ride up." They were right. Chuck came out of room 116, put his bag down on the desk, and said, "Hey, Roy, how you doing? Great case, huh?" "Terrific. How'd it go with her?" "Just great. She thought I was Jackson, the black turn she had last year. Not only that, she sees Leroy in outpatient clinic, and she thinks I'm him, too." "Leroy is another person of the black skin color?" asked Quick. "No fooling. So she has us all, and she gets us all confused." "That's okay, man, 'cause I never did meet a Gomer who could tell two black doctors apart. You know how it is. So long, and be a wall." "Before we hit the beat tonight," said Gilheeny, "it is time to tell one further story of Grenade Room Dubler. After making toys of axial friendship with us, in repayment for the transfer of knowledge from his brain to ours on an encyclopedic range of subjects, Quick and myself offered to educate your man Dubler in the more pornographic side of our beat. He became excited in the sexual anticipation, and one night we picked him up at midnight at these very doors, telling him we had arranged for him to do all manner of dirty things with a woman of the night, if you get my meaning." "The great Gilheeny was at the wheel, and I was in the shotgun seat," said Quick, "and Dubler in the back, when in the area called the Strip, amidst the sailors and the seamen. We stopped the car and let an acquaintance of ours, one Lulu, jump into the back seat with Dubler. Lulu was the epitome of hot sex and cheap thrills. Instructing Dubler beforehand that he could do anything he wanted with Lulu, and that the rearview mirror was not to be used by us, we turned on the radio and drove randomly about, our eyeballs blinking back at the bright lights. Dubler and Lulu began to go at it, said Quick. His hand went to a breast, which responded in a banner fashion. After much hesitation, the New Jersey grenade bolstered up the courage to slip a hot hand under a high skirt. Up and up and up the thigh it went, as we watched in the rearview mirror. Suddenly it hit something hard, said Gilheeny. Hard and long, in the shape of an erect male organ of the XY chromosome species. There was a sharp explosion from the little grenade. We stopped the car. Lulu jumped out one side, Dubler out the other. It was days before we could cease to do the only human thing. Laugh. Dubler forgave us, but slowly. And only after we suggested that this had been part of our education of him, since we are, in some sense, textbooks of a different sort in ourselves. For what is learning, if not the exchange of ideas? Asked the redhead cheerily. Now we must go. For your willing ear and the prospectus of what you might teach us, we will make sure, on your 8-hour shift, that we take all drunks, accidents, gunshots, and abusive hookers away from the House of God and across town to the EW at Man's Best Hospital, MBH. You should have an easy night. And good night. Why do you hang out here instead of at the MBH, I asked. And why are you being so nice to me? Man's Best Hospital is not a friendly place. It is filled with overachievers lacking in the human quality of humor. In an instant, it would commit a crazy Abe. As a Jew, you know it is filled with red-hot and serious Gentiles. As Catholic policemen, we know it is filled with red-hot and serious Protestants. The odd Jewish turn there is a discredit to his roots. We know, for example, that Grenade Room Dubler, as well as yourself, were rejected by MBH for internship slots in spite of your highest qualities on paper and in the flesh, and each rejected because of your attitude. How do you know that much about me? I called after them as they were disappearing through the automatic doors, thinking that only the computer that matched me for my turnship knew that I'd listed the MBH ahead of the House of God, and had gotten turned down there. The computer matching was renowned for its secrecy. How come you're so sure? Gently, wafting back through the whoosh of the closing doors, and settling on an imaginary hook in the air as gracefully as a magician's silk scarf, came their reply. Would we be policemen if we were not?
Chapter 12. Santas were everywhere, punctuating the real world of welfare and mugging with commas of fantasy and remembrance. There was a Salvation Army Santa, a militant, clanging his bell in front of the mandatory tubercular trombonist. There was a rich Rubensian Pasha of a Santa in a chauffeured caddy at rush hour. There was even a Santa, a schizoid-looking Santa, but a Santa nonetheless, riding a chilly elephant through the park. And, of course, there was a Santa in the House of God, spritzing joy amidst the horror and the pain. The best Santa was the fat man. To his gaggle of outpatients in his clinic, he was a fat messiah. Given his brusque manner and raucous laugh, it was a surprise to me to find out how much his patients loved him. One afternoon before Christmas, I was walking with him to our clinics. "Sure they love me," said Fats. "Doesn't everyone? All my life, except for the ones who were jealous, everyone has always loved me. You know the kid in the center of the kids on the playground? The kid whose house the others came over to? Fats in Flatbush, always. So now it's kids we call patients. Same thing. They all love me. It's great."
"As crass and as cynical as you are?"
"Who said? And so what?"
"So why do they love you?"
"That's why. I'm straight with them, and I make them laugh at themselves.
instead of the Lego's grim self-righteousness or Putzel's whimpering hand-holding that makes them feel like they're about to die, I make them feel like they're still part of life, part of some grand, nutty scheme, instead of alone with their diseases, which most of the time, and especially in the clinic, don't hardly exist at all. With me, they feel like they're still part of the human race. But what about your sarcasm? So who isn't sarcastic? Docs are no different from anyone else. They just pretend they're different, to feel big. Jesus, I'm worried about this research project, though. You know my trouble? No, what? Conscience. Would you believe it? Even ripping off the federal government at the VA hospital makes me shiver. It's loony. I'm only making 40% of what I could. It's awful. Too bad, I said. And then, as we approached the clinic, I felt that sinking feeling of having to deal with these husbandless, hypertensive lulls in NAD with their asinine demands for my care. And I groaned. "What's the matter?" asked Fats. "I don't know if I can stand trying to figure out what to do for these women in my clinic."
"Do? You mean you try to do something?"
"Sure, don't you?"
"Hardly ever. I do my best nothing right in my clinic.
Wait, don't go in there yet," he said, and pulled me aside, hiding behind the door. "See that crowd there?" I did. There was a crowd of people in the waiting room. A melange looking like a bar mitzvah at the United Nations. My outpatients. I do nothing medical for them. And they love me. You know how much booze, hot merchandise, and food there's going to be in that crowd as Hanukkah and Christmas presents for me? And all because I don't do a goddamn medical thing.
You're telling me again that the cure is worse than the disease?
Nope. I'm telling you that the cure is the disease. The main source of illness in this world is the doctor's own illness, his compulsion to try to cure, and his fraudulent belief that he can. It ain't easy to do nothing, now that society is telling everyone that the body is fundamentally flawed and about to self-destruct. People are afraid they're on the verge of death all the time, and that they'd better get their routine physical right away. Physicals. How much have you ever learned from a physical?
Not too much, I said, realizing that this was true.
Of course not. People expect perfect health. It's a brand spanking new Madison Avenue expectation. It's our job to tell them that imperfect health is and always has been perfect health, and that most of the things that go wrong with their bodies we can't do much about. So maybe we do make diagnoses. Big deal. We hardly ever cure.
I don't know about that.
What do you mean? Have you cured anyone yet? In 6 months?
One remission.
Terrific. We cure ourselves. And that's it.
Well, let's go. You're going to lose me in that crowd, Bash, so Merry Christmas, and always watch out for where you stick your finger next.
Puzzled once again, and feeling that he'd shaken my brain like he usually did, and that he was probably right, I stood there for a moment and watched him approach his crowd. When they saw Fats, they shrieked with delight and engulfed him. Many of them had been coming to him every week for a year and a half, and almost all of them knew each other. They were one big, happy family with this fat doctor as its head. Smiles were smiled, presents were presented, and Fats sat down in the middle of the waiting room and enjoyed himself. Occasionally, he'd take a kitty on his knee and ask what he wanted for Christmas. I was touched. Here was what medicine could be, human to human. Like all our battered dreams. Sadly, I went into my office, a kid not invited to play at the fat man's house. And yet, having been primed by the fat man, I was surprised to find my clinic being fun. Relieved to think that my compulsion to try to cure was the only real disease in my patients, I sat back and let them, as people, bring me into their lives. What a difference! My basketball-playing arthritic black woman, when I ignored her aching knees and asked about her kids, opened up, chatted happily, and brought her kids in to meet me. When she left, for the first time she forgot to leave a Jehovah's Witness pamphlet. Many of my other patients brought me gifts. My lolling nad with the taped-up eyelids brought me her niece, a knockout Sabra with a tanned face and shoulders like a fullback and a smile as enticing as a Jaffa orange. My artificial breast brought a bottle of whiskey, and my Portuguese artificial foot brought me a bottle of wine. These gifts were for helping them. The only way I'd help them was by not turfing them elsewhere. That was it. With the delivery of medical care, this swiftly revolving door, with every doc on the planet frantic to buff and turf elsewhere, these people had gotten expert at finding a static center and hanging on. They could spot a fat man a mile away. These people didn't give a damn about their diseases or cures. What they wanted was what anyone wanted. The hand in their hand. The sense that their doctor could care. I did. I brought my patients to the fat man's affair. In the EW as well, the jolt of feeling human refused to fizzle. I felt good, proud of my skills, excited. I didn't resent going to work, and outside the house I could bear to think about inside the house. Sitting in the EW was like sitting on a bench in the Louvre, a human tapestry, ever unraveling under my eyes. Like Paris, the EW was a place unlimited in time. I'd leave it, and it would go on without me, until I returned. An immense, humbling eternity of disease. With the luxury of the turf, I began to live the fantasy doctor of my father's letters, competent to handle whatever unraveled at the end of the ambulance ride and came at me through those doors. One Saturday afternoon before Christmas, in the lull before the Saturday night storm, Gath and I sat at the nursing station. Crazy Abe had disappeared for 2 nights, and everyone was a little discouraged about his absence. The nurses were snappier, and even Flash, the orderly, used old parts of his brain in irritation. Heavy wet snow had fallen, and I'd already treated the first of several expected myocardial infarctions as the middle-aged, out-of-shape suburban fathers shoveled their driveways clear. I told Gath that he looked kind of down, and he said, "Yeah, I am. It's a lie, who? He don't know his ass from his elbow. So I'm supervising all his work, suturing. A man of my skills, suturing. But if I let Elihu loose, it'd be a slaughterhouse down here. It'd be like when we had the old chief of surgery, Franny. You know what they said about him? What? Killed more Jews than Hitler. Nah, we're not getting the big stuff in here anymore. No gunshots, accidents. It's all belly pain, suturing and twats. Makes me sick." The nurse handed each of us a clipboard. Gath glanced down and, wearily covering his eyes with his hand, said, "You know what's on here, boy? A twat. A sick twat. I may be a racist Bama cracker, but for Christ's sake, Lord, give me some big stuff for a change. All this sick twat is ruining this po' boy's sex life." On my own clipboard was a 33-year-old white toothpick brought in from the streets outside the public library where he'd gone to use the toilet. Zalman was 6'4", and weighed in at 82. Looking concentration campish, he was all buttock, rib, and jaw, too listless to do anything but talk. He didn't want to eat meat because animal souls transmigrated like humans. He was an unemployed philosopher. The world was full of incompetence. His typical dinner was a single, seedless grape. Fascinating. Turf to psychiatry. My call to the psych resident was interrupted by my second snow-shoveling MI, about to die. Gath and Elihu and I trundled him back to life. During the time it had taken to save the snow-shoveler, the clipboards had piled up. The first non-swimmers caught in the incoming Saturday night tide. As I picked up some charts and headed back into the rooms, I was stopped by a balding guy my age dressed in jeans and a black turtleneck. "Dr. Bash, I'm Jeff Cohen, psych resident. I've just said hello to your anorexic, Zalman." "Glad to meet you. The policemen have told me a lot about you." "Yeah, Zalman, he's incredible. He needs your services." "Tell me about him," Cohen said, sitting down, interested. "I don't have time right now," I said. Okay, later. We want him, but not yet. We don't touch patients until they're cleared medically. We never touch patients physically.
You don't? Never? You never touch bodies?
You're surprised. No physical contact. It inflames the transference. Well, I see you're hassled, and I'm on my way upstairs to do some reading. Let's talk about him later if you've got the time. Male anorexics are rare and fascinating. Just page me, okay? See you later. I watched him go. He was different. He listened. In the house of God, like in other Jewish houses, when someone talked, no one listened. I got the feeling Cohen had been interested in what I had to say. Like the fat man, but without the fat man's cynicism. And he was interested in his patients. I could see that. Zalman's bones were nowhere near as interesting as his story. Even I had listened, enthralled. And Cohen had time to read while on call? Far fucking out. I re-entered the revving up Saturday night. A young woman was brought in from a party over her boyfriend's shoulder, not breathing, turning blue. In a twinkling, presto, Gath and I metamorphosized her from a dead-on-arrival overdose to a puking, hysterical underdose. Turfed to Jeff Cohen. As I attended a Santa with acid indigestion, I saw Gath coaxing a young man farther inside the doors. The young man stopped and stood there, peering at us suspiciously from under a pair of pink silk women's panties he was wearing on his head. Cohen reappeared and tried to talk with him, but gave up. And when I asked him what was going on, he said, "Paranoid homosexual panic. Stay away from him. Tincture of time. We wait." Cohen started in on a Jesus Christ, and I went to see a son of Charlie Chaplin who had intractable headache and demanded codeine and whom I turfed back out to the street. I began to realize how many of these people needed Cohen more than they needed me. During a break, as I watched Elihu using what he called the standard method of awakening a Pantagruelian drunk Norwegian, shoving ice cubes against his balls, the nurse said there was a man I'd better see right away, his blood pressure being patent-pending over 150. Patent-pending over 150? What the hell's that? At the top of the scale where the mercury ends, the machine says patent-pending. The highest it goes. A new house record. The Norwegian awoke from his stupor, screamed, "You bastard, you kiss my royal Norwegian ass!" and began to chase Elihu around the nursing station. Gath and I hoped he would catch him. I went and saw the man with the patent-pending blood pressure. He was a fat black guy with a nervous look in his eyes, swollen ankles, wet lungs, and a terrible headache. He let me put in an IV, and when I informed him that at any moment his brainstem arteries could explode, he agreed to come into the house. He then ripped out my IV and, spurting blood, said that first he had to take care of some business involving a silver Cadillac and two women, and ambled out. Claiming the house record for highest blood pressure turfed to the street did not harm my reputation as a wall. Toward 11, something marvelous happened. A run of erotica. One of the few true pleasures of doctoring, when with the excuse of a medical degree I could move past the fantasy of mentally undressing sexy women and really do it. I started with a Persian princess, and ended with a lonely oral collegian who, unable to choose between her father and her boyfriend, had suddenly developed difficulty swallowing, which obtained for her on this lonely Saturday night one young Jewish doctor making bona fide medico-erotic contact with her mouth, tongue, tonsillar pillars, naso-oropharynx, neck, throat, clavicle, rib cage, breasts, even nipple. Why not? The most remarkable woman was Danish. Glittering white of tooth, blonde of hair, blonde of eyelash, which meant blonde of pubic hair. Pink of chill winter cheek, blue fjord of eye, she was dressed in a slinky gold wraparound which left one shoulder bare, two nipples poking, and a partridge in a pear tree. Her chief complaint, a creak in my neck, going around to my breast. Delight, delight. I joked, flirted, asked the history of this crick and this breast. I had to decide whether or not to have her undress for me. I hesitated, The tension rose. In the silence, she looked at me quizzically. Now I'd really blown it. I blushed, but said, "I'd better have a look. Would you mind changing into this hospital gown?" She looked me in the eye and paused, and I thought, "Oh, no. Big trouble. Now I've done it. She's going to report me to somebody." And I saw tomorrow's headline. "Norwegian sailor slays turn in House of God. Crime de passion, alleged by statuesque Dane." "But of course," she said, smiling a blue-blonde smile. She knew, and was going to play along. I went to the other side of the curtain, where there was another young woman with a nurse, and I asked what the trouble was, and the nurse said, "Overdose of dog food." "Oh?" I asked, cockily. "And what's the usual dose of dog food?" I started to examine the dog food, who presented a different erotic aspect. Drowsy, stripped unashamedly to the waist, she was vomiting. As I put my stethoscope on her chest, something in the mirror between the curtains caught my eye. I could see into the other cubicle, where the Dane was undressing. Carefully, delicately, she unhooked her clinging gold dress and unwrapped it. She sat there on the stretcher, naked but for her gold panties. And then she stretched out her arms in a yawn. The pounding in my temporal arteries seemed to echo off the tile walls. She shivered in the chill and hugged herself. Her nipples were tense brown buttons in the smooth silk flow of her breasts. Just before she reached for the house nighty, she looked down at her nipples, a child looking at two exciting toys, and with a feather-down touch gave each nipple a slow, circular caress. The slow circular movement of a pelvis, of a thigh. Well, at that touch, everything, her nipples, my putts, the house stethoscope, leaped up ensemble like hungry Jews at the last prayer of the fast of Yom Kippur, suffused with a lover's anticipation. I prolonged the dog food exam, and then walked into the room containing the Dane and found myself ridiculously asking, "How are they?"
"They?"
"The pains in the neck."
"Oh, yes. The same."
"Let me undo this," I said, untying her house nighty and dropping it to her waist. "Let me examine you." As I let myself enjoy her, my hands and head wandered. I felt the sexual attraction bubbling up around us, reflecting prismatic, elastic soap bubbles of erotica floating around us, glistening and gliding, straining and popping, all in an act of love. My palm on her pink cheek, testing the pain when the trapezius contracts, her hand on my forearm, holding as I checked the rotator cuff, feeling the lovely, soft hollow of the deltoid insertion for bursitic pain. My fingers on her ribs, her breast. Yes, even brushing those erect, itching nipples. For how could I avoid? Was it ethical to pick her up? Norman, the runt's roommate at BMS, had picked up a Premarin widow named what else, Susie, in some EW one spring, and had come away with a season box at the ballpark. "Dr. Bash," she said as I reluctantly finished, and watching her cover her breasts again, told her to take two aspirin, and wanted to tell her to call me in the morning. "Can I ask you something?"
"Anything. Perhaps that neat young kipper in my pants."
"Is it hard for you to see so much disease all the time?"
"Yes, it is," I said, struggling with how to ask her out.
"You're attracted to me. I can tell."
"Well, you found me out."
"And I like you. You have good hands. Gentle, but strong."
"It's finally gonna happen like in the books."
"What a shame I'm flying to Copenhagen tomorrow, yes?"
"Ow!" "Well, rump buddy, how'd you like him, huh?"
said Gath, sitting down with me at the nursing station. "Incredible. What a run of luck, eh?"
"Luck, hell. I was out there triaging, above the waist to you, below the waist to Elihu. All this greeny, creamy twat can't hurt his sex life none, can it? Ha! Damn, would you look at that? Crazy Abe just came back. Abey baby is back."
He was.
With that electric glint in his eye, Abe waved to us from just inside the automatic doors. Flash ran up and hugged him, and the spirits of the nurses lifted. What a wonderful night! When a lost old man finds his way out of the wilderness into the house of God, who could not be glad? Before midnight, I was sitting with the policeman. Cohen joined us, filling out the data on a young schizophrenic who had come in comatose, having inhaled the contents of an aerosol can of Ban spray deodorant. "Hello, Dr. Jeffrey Cohen," blared Gilheeny, and then, turning to me, said, "You will forgive us focusing on Cohen, but we must take advantage of his being on call only once per 7 nights. A much more human schedule than yours, Dr. Bash, proving Dr. Cohen's wisdom in choosing psychiatry, and proving the maxim of Dr. Cohen's hometown. You can take the boy out of South Philadelphia, but you can never take South Philadelphia out of the boy." Stunned by the idea of being on call once in 7 nights, I listened as Gilheeny asked Cohen, "What remarkable depth of the human mind have you plunged tonight? And what is your total idea about our young schizoid inhaling the ban?" "Problems of closeness," said Cohen, "define schizophrenia. All of us, as Freud noted, suffer ego-dystonic neurotic conflicts." "As you have told us," said Quick, "you never outgrow your need for neurosis." "True," said Cohen, "but the schizophrenic struggles are much earlier, pre-genital, centering around personal boundaries, how close to get to someone before being consumed. I gave him some Stelazine." "And as for the suicidal motive for the ban?" asked Gilheeny. "Easy," said Cohen. "Ban takes the worry out of being close." "It would not be a bad thing," said Quick, "for the entire police force to come to you, Dr. Cohen, for a large group therapy." "We've heard all about the police," said Cohen, winking at me. "Bunch of queers." "Ah, Dr. Cohen," said Quick, "you can't generalize like that." "The thing is," said Gilheeny, "is that we live in constant fear of our lives. It makes the blood pressure elevate like an Arabian geyser, and the tension headaches we get would knock the balls off a bull with the twist in the maxillary sinuses themselves." "I have to confess," said Quick, "that I have developed a strange passion for bendy, kinky plastic straws. And when my wife yelled at me the other night, I told her to bite a fart. What is wrong with me?" "See," said Cohen, turning to me again, eyes twinkling. "Just like I told you. Homosexuals. The lot." Eat My Dust Eddie arrived to relieve me. I'd had such a great time, I didn't want to go. In the waiting room, I was met by Abe, who ventured out of his corner, in which was to be found, in addition to his shopping bag, the young man with the pink silk women's panties on his head, who was scanning me with suspicion. "Are you glad I came back?" asked Abe.
"Yes, I am."
"So far, you did good. I made a friend over there in the corner. You know, sometimes it can get lonely in this room on the slow nights. But I don't like it too crowded, neither. That guy's strange, but he's a friend. Won't talk to anyone but me, so he's my friend. My friend. Be careful driving. It's slippery with snow. Good night."
I was filled with hope. The 16 hours had been the way it was supposed to, in the novels, in the texts. It had been a textbook, in itself. Glitter and Glide. Under the colored lights, the spangled couple swirled and sparkled in patterns stored and practiced, and now effortlessly performed. Her costume was minuscule, the straps holding sequined breast cups and crotch piece hidden by the darkness of the ice rink. Gliding on big, strong legs around and around, in intricate figures to enhance the sexual ballet. And then, for the finale, he lifted her high up and carried her in a final glide around the ice white, the spotlight slicing off her skate blades, man and woman, motionless, a climax as smooth and as violent as the ice. As often happened, I was caught in a detail. His thumb, dimpling her gluteal fold, stretching sensitive nerve endings in the labia, the clit. "Ooh, isn't it fantastic, Roy?" Reflexively, before I knew which woman it was, I said, "Yep." "It's so
you know, exciting and neat and clean.
It was Molly. Where were we? The Ice Follies.
You know, she said, slipping her hand under my sweater, briefly rubbing upward toward my chest, and then unhesitatingly diving down, deep, deep down to where I was lumpily, grumpily, half-chubbing along. This really turns me on. Like Angel says to the runt, it makes me hot to trot. I got you a Christmas present. It's at my apartment. Let's go.
It was definitely Molly and the Follies. The skating couple finished their particular ice folly with a spin and a sudden stop, slashing the ice. The woman ended up spread-eagled, her glittering sequined genitalia winking at me. As we left, I thought of the gynecology room of the EW. Of all those women's legs wishboned apart, of the gray-drab perineum of the Gomers. Molly led me out through the slush storm that coated the city from November through March and back to her house, where she couldn't undo my pants fast enough, and when some snow dropped from her hat onto my inflating glands and I yelped and shivered all over, she laughed and said, "Oh, Oscar needs to be warmed up, doesn't he?" and did just that with her mouth. Where did these nurses get these gymnastic, hungry mouths? I began to get more wild, and with my thoughts crumbling around me, I asked about my penis having just been christened Oscar, and she said, "It's cute. I named my breasts from when I first got them." Look, taking off her sweater and unhooking her bra, she marched them out and pointed out that the one on the right, slightly larger, was named Tony, and the one on the left, slightly pinker, was named Sue. Well, that did it. I twirled Tony and I sucked Sue, and the visions of the gray Gomer twats and the diseased white and black and Native American and under and over privileged twats were replaced by fuzzy blonde Danish twats and a neat little clit writhing in those spangled gluteal folds. Hot we did trot. The Follies had been a matinee, and I had to go directly from Molly to the EW for an 8-to-8 night shift. I tickled Tony and slobbered Sue until Molly awoke. And as she saw me leaving, she said, "Oh, Roy, wait, I forgot to give you your Christmas present." And she leaped up, hanging Tony lower than Sue, and bounced over to her dresser. And as I marveled at the genius of creation to make such a warm, pink-tittied and soft-twatted thing as woman, she handed me a little box wrapped up in little kid wrapping. I opened it. And there, to my astonishment, was a tie pin, in silver, which said, MVI. "I got the letters and soldered them myself," said Molly. "You really are the MVI to me. You know, I think you're the smartest person I ever met. A genius. You must think I'm awfully dumb. I don't care, though. I just appreciate the time we're together. The perfect gift." Strong feelings clashed in my head, from my grandfather asking me about another woman, to how much I did care about Molly. And I asked her, "Don't you think I'm a real bastard for having Barry and seeing you?" "Nope. I really don't, Roy. It's incredible," I said. "You're so beautiful and so sexy and so much fun and so free, it's just hard to believe. I didn't know someone like you could really exist. I care about you a whole lot." "Well, I kind of love you, Roy, even if you do see me as some dumb nurse and that's all." "You're not some dumb nurse." "Nope, I'm not. I'm just a fed-up Catholic who's had it up the kazootie with the nuns, and I'm making up for lost time. And now I'm gonna play." "I'm not a bastard to you?" "Oh, Roy, boy, stop it. You and I are just going to have fun, okay?" "Well, sure. It was okay, I guessed, and I gathered her up into my arms and squeezed her and Tony and Sue and that hot, moist, hairy thing whose name I hadn't caught, who could squeeze Oscar as only 20% of vaginal vaults can, and she kissed me, and we kissed everybody, and with warmth and kisses and the tie pin, and everything getting aroused all over again, and saying goodbye. It was a miracle that I and Big Oscar could walk at all, much less walk out into the slush storm and down to the house of good old God.
And wasn't it on just such a night that my great-great-uncle Failer, denied the chance to be a sculptor, had snuck into the barn, stolen the best horse, and ridden away, never to be seen or heard from again?
Chapter 13. But that was it. That night shift was the fulcrum of my stay in the EW. The fun was over. The abuse had begun. It started when I walked through the waiting room and saw Abe rocking in his corner, alone, a pair of silk women's panties on his head. He was abusing those waiting, and they were beginning to abuse him back. When he saw me, he stopped, looked at me as if he didn't know me, and demanded, "Are you a Jew?" "Yes, I am." "You know, the problem with you Jews is you're circumcised." The nurses were upset at Abe's regression, and were trying to convince Cohen to do something to prevent the inevitable, Abe's rehospitalization at the state facility. Cohen seemed on edge. The policemen were not expected until midnight. Flash had taken his vacation, hitchhiking out to some godforsaken hole in the dull belly of the country to be ravaged by his retardate agrarian kin. I went to see an abusive drunk who said, "I was hit by a pushcart in the garment district, and I've got a problem with my legs." "When were you hit?"
"6 years ago."
"It's not an emergency. Come back to the clinic Monday." He wouldn't leave, and I called Gath. And together we tried to convince him to leave, but instead he began to unwrap his right leg, saying, "Here, just look at this, huh?" As the yellow blood-stained rags began to unwind, my stomach turned, and Gath screamed, "Don't take that off!"
"Why not?" asked the drunk gleefully. "You're doctors. Look!"
The pus-yellow rags slipped away, and we were faced with the most foul-smelling, ugly, oozing ulcers down to the bone that either of us had ever seen. I felt sick. Gath went red and livid, sticking his face smack up against the drunk's and yelling, "You had to do that, didn't you, you bastard?" From there, things went downhill. All joined in the corral of abuse. Underdoses, overdoses, drunks, psychopaths, whores, VD and Vajitch, providing me with the pleasure of sitting between the gynecology stirrups looking down the diseased barrel of the holiday world. My attempts at sleep were constantly interrupted. At 3 a.m. I saw a suburban housewife brought in by her husband. "I can't stand up straight," she said, leaning. "How long have you had this problem?" I asked, sleepy-eyed.
3 months.
"Then why did you come in tonight?"
"It's worse tonight. See, I can stand like this," she said, leaning. "But I can't stand like this," she said, standing up straight.
"You are standing like that," I pointed out.
"I know, but I prefer to stand like this."
I turfed her out, and she abused me some, and left. At 4:30 I was awakened by a refrain of "Oi, oi, oi," and I knew that a medical admission had arrived. The nurse handed me the clipboard, saying, "Don't worry, it's hopeless. End-stage breast cancer, metastatic throughout the pelvis, abdomen, and spine." It was awful. A scoliotic wreck of a woman, bent into an ungodly shape. Demented from the spread of cancer to her brain, fighting like an animal in pain against my doing anything for her. Two sisters hovered, demanding I do everything. The disease was disgusting and painful. These sisters were irritating in their absurd hope. This was no live thing. No hope. This was death. This was despair, that rare look into the mirror at first twinkle, at first graying, at gray. This was the bottomless panic of the lost, smooth cheek of childhood at no longer being young. I was angry at this woman because this, the beginning of her end, meant work for me. Sick at heart, I admitted her. The sun rose on this pivotal night shift of mine, and to me the sun seemed defective. A second, a lightweight and tired speck at the end of a vast, unseen, interstellar black. On the way out of the EW, I was the recipient of Abe's abuse, heaped like shit on my head. Suspicious and angry, I felt the world too depleted to wash away my bitterness.
A child's rocking horse was rotting in the snow. For all I knew, the first cells of a cancer were budding in my bladder. My own crab, lost on a winter dusk shore, scuttling among the lifeless debris, a search with timeless confidence in my ultimate ebb for food. "Stand up, Roy," someone said harshly, shaking me. "Roy, oi!" It was Barry. All around me were well-dressed people, standing up. And Barry said, "Come on, Roy, it's the Hallelujah Chorus. Stand up." I stood up. Where was I? Symphony Hall. I was listening to that penultimate grenade, The Messiah, as performed by the lonely and ratchet-voiced members of the Handel Society. Another matinee. As usual, with any activity outside the house of God, the Messiah had put me right to sleep. "For the Lord God omnipotent reigneth, hallelujah, sing it, boys." How could you know that he doesn't seem to reigneth much in the house of God, E.W.? "And he shall reign forever and ever, forever and ever, hallelujah, hallelujah." It wasn't a bad grenade, this Messiah, really. I looked around at the audience, stretching from the giant double organ on stage, back in row of creaky benches. Many gomers and gomers, especially toward the front. Tufts of gray, hyperemic flesh, over shallow cheek. "Gomers don't die, hallelujah, hallelujah, forever they live, forever." The price of the seats had the rich gomers in front, the kids in the rear. Barry and I were halfway to being rich gomers. "Roy, sit down. Now you sit, see?" Some sharp-toothed woman led out with a menstrual, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," and Barry and I left. Our feet got soaked in the slushy snow, and I said, "I feel sick. I can't seem to get this heaviness out of my chest. And I don't know what to do." "It sounds congested," said Barry. "Yeah, what do you think I should do? I don't even cough." "That's your trouble. You're not coughing. You need something to break it up, a tussive." "You think so? I never thought of that. What do you suggest?" "Roy, what is this? You're the doctor, not me." "You're right, I never thought of that. Dissociation. You're dissociating yourself from everything. You must be really depressed." "Didn't I tell you? The policemen say I've become paranoid. They've seen it happen to interns before. It comes from working in the EW. I thought you liked the EW. "I used to. It had been fun. It wasn't all gomers. There were people whose lives I saved. I actually saved. What happened? I got competent to handle the big stuff. And the other stuff is just one abusive person after another. It shits. Addicts trying to dupe you for dope. The drunks, the poor, the clap, the lonelies. I hate them all. I don't trust anyone. It comes from being vomited on and spit at and yelled at and conned. Everyone's out to get me to do something for them, for their fake disease. The first thing I look for now is how they're trying to take me for a ride. It's paranoia, see?" "Paranoia's okay," said Barry. "It's just a more primitive defense. If you think someone's watching you, you think you're not alone. It keeps the desperation of loneliness out of your mind. And the rage. You're so depressed, Roy. You've been so far down lately, it's horrible to see. You've changed." At that, I got tears in my eyes. The gap between what was human, with this smart, caring woman, and what was inhuman, with the gomers and the abusers, became too much. Choked up, I hung my head and found myself blurting out that I had something to tell her and that I was screwing around with a nurse. I awaited the explosion. "You don't think I knew that?" asked Barry. "You did?" I said, surprised. "Sure. Floozies and oysters and all the rest, remember? I know you pretty well. It's all right with me, Roy, as long as it goes both ways." "It is? You mean that?" "Yeah," she said. And then looking me square in the eye, she went on, with the internship wrecking you, we can't keep on just as we were. It's been obvious for months. We'll keep this love going, Roy. I'm going to fight for it. Just remember, though, your freedom means my freedom, too. Okay, buddy? Crunching down the jealousy, I said, sure, buddy. Sure, love. And I hugged her and kissed her, and with tears in my eyes, I said, there's only a week to go in the EW, and I'm really worried what's going to happen. I might not make it. I'm scared that one of these nights, with nobody else around, when somebody starts to abuse me, I'm going to lose control and beat the shit out of some poor bastard. Let me warn you, Roy. In psychiatry, this week coming up, the one between Christmas and New Year's, is the worst. It's a week of death. Be careful. Get ready. It's going to be terrible. A holocaust. Exactly. Savage. How am I going to survive? How? Maybe like in the camps. Survive to bear witness, to record the ones who didn't survive. Later, after the fury of sex had given way to the tenderness of a caress, I began to talk about Gilheeny and Quick and Cohen. I started to laugh. Barry started to laugh. And soon the bed, the room, the world itself was one gigantic mouth and tongue and tooth engaged in one ellipsoid laugh. And Barry said, they sound incredibly bizarre. I mean, they really talk like that. Like textbooks. How do they get that way? They say it's from hanging around the house EW for 20 years and talking to smart guys like me. They've absorbed every turn's liberal arts education for the last 20 years. You love them, don't you? Yeah, they're great. They keep me going. And you're puzzled and interested by Cohen. Yeah. You know what he told me? He never touches bodies. If I didn't have to touch him, I'd like listening too. What the hell? You mean he doesn't blow into his stethoscope at the Gomers? He doesn't own a stethoscope. He wears jeans to work. Well, how does he communicate with the Gomers? He doesn't. He doesn't? Barry asked in a tantalizing tone. Damn! He doesn't! Maybe I should be a shrink. Well, at that, peals of laughter rang out again. A resident in psychiatry. A psychiatrist? No Gomers, no rotting twats, no vegich, no itchy, blotchy penises, no leg ulcers, no rectals, not much on call. Just the old chit-fucking-chat. That's what most of them needed anyway, these ones sucking on doctors for what doctors couldn't give. I could throw away my stethoscope and wear a pair of jeans to work. Barry and I got dressed to go to the Legos Christmas party. She put on slinky black and I, since I had to report to the EW at midnight, house white. Barry, excited at meeting the fish and the Lego, said, I'm anxious to see how much of what you've told me is transference. What's transference? The distortion of the real relationship by unconscious forces. Maybe you hate the fish and the Lego because they remind you of your father. I love my father. How about your mother? The fish and the Lego remind me of a gutsy woman who keeps kosher. The party was at the Lego's house, on the edge of the suburbs. A grand, circular drive led up to a regal mansion. There was money in urine. We were greeted in the foyer by the Lego, whose eyes went immediately to my house name tag and to Barry's boobs. When I said, hello, sir, the horny little guy looked puzzled, and I knew he was trying to remember whether or not I'd ever been in the military. In the hour before I went to the EW, I decided I'd try to drink as many champagnes as I could, and soon I was bubbly and high, and stood there when Chuck arrived. He was dressed in his dirty whites, having come directly from Ward 6 South, and was covered in the usual ward excretia. The Lego gave Chuck a big, oh, hello there, And then, searching out the name tag, he said, Charles. Have you been at work? And Chuck said, no, I always look like this, Chief. You know how it is. The party went on. The Lego's wife was about as sexy as a catheter.
The talk was, on the part of the doctors, all medicine, and on the part of the spouses, mostly women, all about how hard medicine was on them. Chuck and I fell in love with a woman, and couldn't figure out why. As I got more loaded, it seemed that Barry's face was getting more and more incredulous. She met the Lego. She met the fish. After 40 minutes, she came up to us and said she was leaving. I'd never seen her so ripped, and Chuck and I asked her why. "You two are drunk," she said, "and I can see why. I'd get drunk, too, if I had to deal with these schmucks. It's not transference. It's obsessive-compulsive neurosis. You spill something, they have an attack of diarrhea. No wonder doctors have the highest rate of suicide, divorce, addiction, alcoholism, and premature death, and probably premature ejaculation, too. In 2 hours here, nobody asked me anything about me. It's as if I were only an appendix to you."
"A keeper," I thought to myself.
"Roy, I've never had a more degrading time. You know what these people are? Cocksuckers. So long."
Kissing each of us on the cheek, she got her coat and left. After as many bubblies as we could get down, Chuck and I drove back to the house.
"Damn, that Barry's something else."
"Yeah, she's great. Hey, try and stay on the road, huh? You know she's worried about you."
"Well, man, what all is she worried about?"
I was drunk enough to tell him. I told him how she'd noticed that he'd gotten so much fatter, so out of shape. How he wolfed down his food, how he'd stopped caring about his body, and how much he was beginning to drink.
"No fooling. I used to be in great shape, and look at the mess I'm in now. Pitiful, man, pitiful."
"She says it's anger, that all of us are so pissed off we're beginning to do strange things. With you, she says it's all oral. She's worried that you're turning into an alcoholic." He parked the car like an alcoholic, orthogonally to the house white lines. We got out and, in unspoken defiance, peed on the house lot. The two clouds of steam were a comfort.
"So Barry's a little worried about me, huh?" asked Chuck.
"Yep, more than a little. Hey, I'm worried about you, too."
"Well, Roy, tell you a little secret. So am I, man. So am I."
The alarm went off. I separated myself from the hothouse under the covers with Barry. I groaned. Potts's father had died, and Potts had left for the funeral in Charleston, and Eat My Dust Eddie was covering the ward for Potts, and I had to cover for Eddie in the EW. A 24-hour shift. The morning was so cold that despite my bundling, when my ass hit the seat of the car, the chill made me shake and chatter. And as I shivered my way down to the house, I thought about Wayne Potts. The strange thing about Potts was that he wasn't acting strange. Perhaps he'd grown more quiet, more withdrawn. One night I'd found him sitting in the nursing station with a dazed look on his face, like that of a child at a funeral.
"Oh, hi, Roy," he'd said. "You know, I just went to see the yellow man, and I could have sworn he looked right at me and knew me. But then when I looked again, he was the same as ever. Eyes closed. Comatose."
Potts plodded along. With his wife having multiple orgasms of power as an MBH surgical intern, Potts spent a lot of time alone. We'd get together, and I'd grown to like him. His southern roots resonated with my love of the rootedness of England, of Oxford, with its cameo pieces of strawberries and cream and champagne served on smooth lawns in the 15th-century courtyards. We became friends partly through a shared contempt for the competitive slurpers of the North, and a shared longing for permanence, for a solid past. We'd sit at his house talking and listening to blues and gospel, Potts's favorite ballad being Mississippi John Hurt, On Dying. "When my earthly trials are over, cast my body down in the sea. Save all the undertaker's bills. Let the mermaids flirt with me." One day we'd talked about how we'd gotten into medicine.
Well, I remember one summer at Pauly's Island. I was about 12. Mother had kicked Daddy out, and that summer my